Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have David Rosenberg, Ira Harris, and Peter Buchvar. David is Chief Economist and Strategist at Gluskin Sheff. He has a focus on providing a top-down perspective to the firm's investment process and asset mix committee. Prior to joining Gluskin Sheff, David was chief North American economist at Merrill Lynch in New York for 7 years, during which he was consistently ranked Institutional Investor All-Star Analyst Ranking. Prior thereto, he was chief economist and strategist for Merrill Lynch Canada, based out of Toronto. He's the author of Breakfast with Dave and Espresso with Dave, publications of his economic and financial market insights. Ira's hedge fund manager, global trader in foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003. And Peter is chief investment officer for the Bleakley Financial Group and Advisory. He has a newsletter product called bookreport.com that's spelled bookreport.com, which has great macroeconomic insight and perspective with lots of updates on economic indicators. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks, Richard.
Great to be on.
Thanks, Richard.
Great. I thought we'd begin with a discussion on the economy, recession views, corporate deleveraging cycle. David, your thoughts on that in terms of what's happening overall?
Well, I'd be happy to start that off since my call for the year was a corporate-led recession. Of course, always difficult to know, which week, month, or quarter it could line up. And I never found an economist that was actually a very good market timer, because if we were, we'd be managing money for a living. But I thought that, what's timely here is that this week the New York Fed published its model-based recession odds metric for the coming year, and it rose to 33%, which is a 12-year high. This time last year was 12%. 2 years ago, it was 10%. 3 years ago, it was 8%. So we're up to 1 in 3 odds on this metric. And what's interesting is that when you go back in time, you'll see that once you cross above 30%, more often than not, you actually get an official recession. Of course, nobody ever sees it at the time. But I think we'll all look back and say, oh, yeah, guess what? When the yield started inverting towards the end of last year, the yield curve got it right once again. I think that, we layer on a lot of the geopolitical and domestic political constraints on certainly corporate spending right now. The tariff war has yet to really be resolved. So we have these other nagging concerns, but all the recessions that we've had in the post-World War II period, there's been 10 of them, they all were precipitated by a Fed rate hiking cycle. We only had 3 soft landings. So I was saying all along that the odds are 85% that we have a recession this year. The New York Fed model is certainly pointing in that direction. And I know that people say to me, well, how on earth can you be talking about a recession when, real GDP in the first quarter was 3.1%? But remember that GDP is about spending, and you really measure a country's standard of living by income. And a very little known well fact that we just got in the past week was that real gross domestic income, which includes profits, and we know that we're in a profits recession right now, it includes personal income, rents, and that combined an interest income as well, dividend income, but real gross domestic income was 1% at an annual rate in the first quarter, and that was after 0.5 in the fourth quarter of last year. So I would say already we are one rung away from seeing the economy turn into recession, and we still haven't seen yet all the lags from all the tightening that the Fed put into the system, including the policy misstep last December, kick into the real economy. We're going to be seeing that quarters out. But make no mistake, when you're looking at the real income side of the economy, It's barely growing above zero right now. And that is what the Treasury market has been telling you for the past two or three quarters.
Ira, your thoughts on that and tying that into yield curve indicators and implications?
I love listening to David on that, but it brings me to the point. So tomorrow, I know I'm jumping ahead a little bit. We get Powell's testimony on Wednesday and Thursday. And to make David's point, I would like to hear somebody ask Powell directly about what he, meaning, and he'll speak for the Fed, I know, thinks about the yield curve. Because, you know what, I know I wait for the minutes, and I know the minutes are always sanitized to whatever view they want to push out after the meeting, that they're always, those minutes are reconstructed. And I know Peter and David Price speak better than that even I can. But I'd like to hear his views. And does he look at it? Is it important? And to pursue it? Because as long as I've been doing these, and for 35 years out of the time I've been trading, the yield curves have been very important for me to watch for many different reasons on a global macro basis. So I'm very cognizant of where we are, especially on the 3-month 10-year, even though my favorite trade is to trade the 2-10. But that's been it's been an anomaly, but I think that's due to the ECB more than anything else. And of course, the BOJ as a side, as riding shotgun for that play. But I think David's right. What is this telling us here? You know, and what's the time of it? Well, we're going to soon find out. And it won't all result in the fact that more QE and more liquidity in the system is not going to be the salve that many people think. And I think that's where we're residing right now anyway.
And your thoughts, Peter?
Well, just to add, I mean, you can just look at different parts of the economy. I mean, you can argue that the growth slowdown really began in manufacturing, and whether that was trade and tariff related or something else. The problem right now is that it's now spilling over into the services side, which makes up most of the U.S. economy. So if the service side is now getting infected by the slowdown in manufacturing, since obviously a lot of service companies service manufacturing, there really isn't much left to lean on, since those are the two main areas of the economy. You look at construction, you look at commercial real estate, you look at residential, and that's been softening as well. So there really aren't places to hide, so to speak, in terms of growth. You can argue, okay, maybe the consumer with the help of the labor market is one area keeping things up, but then that gets you to the jobs picture, and the jobs picture is also showing slowing. So each of the key supports of the economy are now getting infected by a general slowdown, and I don't see that reversing anytime soon, and I'm sure that begins to accelerate. I think the next key in sort of quantifying this outside of the GDP numbers and other economic statistics will be what companies say over the next month with respect to earnings. And I'm amazed, at least today, the people sort of blowing off in the U.S., the BASF news in Germany yesterday when they lowered guidance. And this is not just some fly-by-night industrial company in Germany. It's one of the biggest chemical companies in the world. And you can argue that the products that they make, these chemicals, go into pretty much everything. And they have customers all around the world. And that it shouldn't have been too much of a surprise that a chemical company in the midst of a global manufacturing slowdown would have disappointing earnings. But it wasn't disappointing. You know, people didn't assume it was disappointing enough to have it in their estimates, and the stock still fell sharply today. So that, I think, to me, that is the canary for what we're going to see with respect to earnings over the next month. And companies want to protect their earnings. And that means by not spending as much because it's an expense to do so. It's not hiring as much because it's a cost to do so. And these companies are going to do what they can to salvage their profit margins, which also means slowing economic growth. We're seeing it clearly in small businesses, which sometimes this typically starts at, because they're less able to deal with a slowdown. And they're quick to cut, and they're quick to put a timeout on hiring and capital spending. And we saw the small business optimism index today that faltered in a lot of key sectors. We've seen 2 months in a row of ADP reporting that there's a outright decline in small business hiring. And you have to understand the business, this happens in progression, and you can just see how the sort of dominoes are lining up and how this is playing out. And people that are going to rely on the belief that somehow a Fed rate cut or two or three or four somehow are going to matter, it won't, because cost of capital is not the binding constraint on any of this. It's just a general slowdown that's really been affected by tariffs and trade uncertainty. But now once you get a trajectory of growth, it doesn't just end immediately. It's going to continue. And once you get the corporations pulling back, and let's just say the stock market somehow begins to respond to this reduction in earnings, and you get a sell-off in the markets, well, that's going to further affect consumer spending. So again, dominoes are lining up, and I think people should be broadening out their perspective on things to see how this is going to be playing out.
And David, go ahead. Go ahead, Ira.
Yeah, Peter, you've been so good at watching the Cass Freight Index. What's that? Where are you on that now?
Well, I think it's down 6 months in a row, year over year.
Okay.
You know, they like to say that it, in the beginning, it's okay. Maybe it was a rest after a strong 2018, and then it continued month after month after month. And, you know, that's just a direct effect from the slowdown of manufacturing. I mean, it's measuring, you know, every single good that gets manufactured ends up on a truck to its final destination. Well, not whether it's a destination to a warehouse, distribution center, or it's somebody's house. And, you know, that slowdown in manufacturing, which is making these goods, making these products that get shipped, it's just a natural byproduct for shipping weakness to follow the softness in manufacturing.
And David, what do you make of the trends in the Fed policy? Your thoughts on what Peter mentioned. Do you see monetary policy with rates going to zero, more QE, and potential for debt monetization in the future?
Right. Well, you know, this is where, you know, I just had dinner with Peter in New York a couple of weeks ago, and we keep in regular contact, and we know each other's views. I suppose I look at it from a slightly different lens. There's no question in my mind that interest rates are determined by a wide array of factors, but there is a cyclical component to them. And, you know, I would just say, you know, in response to Peter that, you know, we're seeing all these signs of economic slowing. There is a real interest rate component to nominal interest rates that are going to follow the business cycle. And the business cycle this year has been turning the other direction. We're in a very intense economic growth slowdown. Now, the stock market is on a completely different orbit, and we can talk about that. But the relationship between the stock market and the real economy was severed for most of the cycle, in fact. You know, weakest economic cycle on record in terms of magnitude, and one of the best stock markets. And we can talk about some of the factors behind that. But when push comes to shove, really the Fed's broad mandate, if it's a broad mandate, is about the real economy. And so I think that, I think growth is slowing. Inflation is low, with no apparent upside pressure, even with these tariffs. And it would make sense to me that the Fed would be cutting interest rates. And I guess the question will be, and we'll find out more in his testimony and then at the end of the month, more in terms of the tone in the press statement as to how open-ended any further rate cuts are going to be. There's quite a bit already priced in to the curve, even with Friday's employment report. From my lens, you know, I don't rely. I mean, I look at what the Fed's telling us. I look at the Fed's research. I do my own research too. I was saying for a long time that the Fed made their first critical mistake when they stopped cutting their estimate for the neutral funds rate several years ago. They got as low as 2.5%. It's hard to believe, actually, that just 8 years ago, the Fed thought that the neutral funds rate, the funds rate that equilibrates the economy, full employment, price stability, that Nirvana state. It's hard to believe that just 8 years ago, the Fed thought that was 4.25%. Imagine if they went to 4.25%, we'd be seeing a lot of tweets out of the White House if that were to happen. And then they took the neutral funds rate estimate over time because they recognized the forces, the anti-inflation forces of from technology, aging demographics, the fundamental constraint globally of too much debt. And so over time, for a variety of these structural factors, they took down their neutral funds rate, got to 2.75% by the time Jay Powell took over. And the first thing Jay Powell does is not just raise interest rates in his first meeting in 2018, but he raises the estimate for the neutral funds rate and then took it up to 3%. Well, lo and behold, look where they are today. They are 2.5 as of the last meeting. But you see, my work on the neutral rate, the nominal neutral rate, is not 2.5. It's more like 1.5. So my contention has been all along that the Fed over-tightened, not once, not twice. We can talk about last September and last December, as Donald Trump likes to talk about. But actually, the Fed, this is the one thing I will agree with the president on, the Fed over-tightened. And actually, you could see it in the real money supply numbers, which slowed down precipitously heading into the latter part of 2018. And you can see it in the yield curve. You saw it in the prior dollar strength. You saw it in the weakness in commodity prices. This is all the sort of stuff, by the way, that Greenspan used to look at all the time, you know, back in the late 80s and the early 90s. Suffice it to say that I think that the Fed has to take 4 hikes out just to get to neutral. That's what my work shows. And then on top of that, we're going to have all the lagged impacts of what the Fed's already done in terms of their tightening. There's lags that are 2 to 3 years long. We have not seen all the full impact of what the Fed has already done. And then we layer that on top, what Peter was talking about, the general level of uncertainty. And of course, look what's happening abroad right now, the Asian economy, the European economy. It looks like the UK economy is going to be contracting in the second quarter. And what's interesting to me is when Jay Powell gave his comments before the Q&A during the press conference at the last FOMC meeting just after it, he didn't talk about how great the U.S. labor market was. It wasn't about the U.S. labor market. He talked about the global economic weakness 3 times, and he realizes that the only thing separating the weakness abroad to the U.S. economy are just time lags. So my sense is that he's got to move at least 4 times. The market's got that priced in. If I'm right on my recession call, we know historically in recessions, the Fed cuts the funds rate almost 5 percentage points. Their starting point this time is about 2.5%. So not only will they go to 0, and we can then talk, and I know Peter and I will debate, and I'll probably agree with them as to the efficacy and the impact this is going to have on the economy. But I'll tell you that if we go in a recession, the funds rate is going back down to 0, probably more quickly than people think. And yes, they will do more QE. And Peter and I and Ira can sit and lament about how crazy this is. But these policymakers actually believe, without all their interventions and incursions and balance sheet expansion and all the rest of it, they think that things would have been far worse. So they live in a counterfactual world. But they've already told you, when you go and you scan the research at the Fed, at the different Federal Reserve banks, they're already talking about how they're going to fight the next recession. And when you think about every single cycle, since these became balance sheet recessions starting in the late 1980s, when these became debt and asset super cycles, you tend to find that when we go into the recession, the Fed expends more and more and more firepower to get to the recovery phase. We're going to go to 0. They'll try to find some way to generate a synthetic negative interest rate through more QE. And they might do more radical things down the road as well. When you consider, nobody before 2008 had a clue what QE was. You know, my sons know what QE is. You know, it's in the vernacular. I think in a recession, the Fed's going to get extremely aggressive. Rates go to 0. The yield curve will steepen. It's going to melt. And there's going to be a lot of other things, perhaps even including debt monetization, before we climb to the other side of the mountain and get through the next recession.
And your thoughts, Ira, on that, and especially in coordinated central bank monetary policies involving other central banks like the European Central Bank, Bank of Japan, Bank of China?
Yeah, there's no, it's all done with a nod and a wink. I guess I could go look at the G30 because I always go up to see who sits in that group, and there's no question that a lot of this give and take takes place there. And now that we have Christine Lagarde, who that's a whole new phenomenon that's going to play out here. But yeah, there's nothing to, I think David really captures the history of it very well and where we're going. And again, I had this discussion today with a few people that if we go, but there's been so many mistakes that have been made. But to me, the most recent mistake of gigantic proportions was Bernanke's fear of the taper tantrum, and that he backtracked, because had he at least allowed that process to go and let markets begin to better reflect what the reality was underneath, which is they were speaking to. Because, you know, I look at the world and I go, what does central banking want to do? They're not about allowing markets to work. We've gone from George Kennan's concept of containment of the Soviet Union to Ben Bernanke's concept of the containment of markets by central banks. Because they don't want to let markets really signal to them what needs to be done. They want to contain markets from having episodic reactions that they feel are negative to their control of the business cycle. And that's the world in which we live in. And we've all had to adapt to it and change. And we know that it's there. So people say, well, when is it all going to end? I said, I don't know when it's going to end. But I know that historically, and I don't need a model for this, is that when debt expands far greater than economic growth, and you're supporting it through artificially priced interest rates that won't allow the market ever to clear. I'm not talking about mass liquidation of assets. I'm just talking about allowing the market to do some of its work and clear some of the tinder from the bottom of the forest so that it doesn't ignite into a massive fire. And they will not allow it because they're just terrified. And again, well, we saw it with, you know, Jerome Powell. What scared Jerome Powell in late December to make that pivot so quickly? And, you know, it's a binary effect, because we had Mnuchin calling banks, as it was reported, you know, over the Christmas holiday, making sure that they were okay. So what was bothering these different groups of officials? We can go to, you know, FISOC, of course, and they was discussed for that. And what was it that they were afraid of that caused this? But here we are again. And every time you undermine the ability of markets to do what they're supposed to do and send signals, you destroy it, and you wind up having to cover yourself over and over again. So the fact that monetary policy has become meaningless, except the pain from it is going to be real. So there's, you know, I don't know where this goes, but there's certainly people sitting there who believe that the Fed needs to go negative. And Peter Buchmar will tell you, and David will tell you, if you look at the European banking sectors, you look at the Japanese banking sector, do you really want to go there? Is that what you want? Okay, then wipe out banks. They, you know what? Turn them into the utilities of just a parking spot. You don't even have to do that anymore, because if we actually that bank, you know, the people, what's the name of that bank that they're trying to put together that would take deposits and put everything into the deposit it all at the Federal Reserve. You know, there's people working on it, and the Fed is trying to block it from happening, because then they could just take my money, pay me 2.15 and get 2.35 in interest on excess reserves, and you make a 20 basis point, and you're in the safest investment in the world. So this is where we're at, and they're trying to control the whole thing, and they can do it on a day-to-day basis, but I don't really think that they can. And after Peter talks, then I want to throw something out on the table for discussion. So yeah, I'll stop there.
Great. Yeah, Peter, just wondering on your thoughts on that. And you've spoken a lot on negative interest rates in Europe, and with 64% of sovereign government debt there being negative yields, what are your thoughts there? Will that trend continue? And what are the effects on the economy and the financial system?
Well, the effects are obviously evident, as I mentioned, on bank profitability. You know, on one hand, the banks own a lot of these European sovereign bonds that they're benefiting on that end. But the actual business of banking, which is how, at least in Europe, these banks make their money, as opposed to being more reliant on capital markets where U.S. banks profit from, just the standard business of banking is obviously impaired by the yield curve disappearing in that area. And certainly it was the case in Japan, and that's why the Japanese bank stock index is down 90% from its top in 1989. So I think that we're not going to negative interest rates here because of the experience there, but also the U.S. has a very large money market industry of, I think it's $3 trillion of money market money that would essentially disappear if we went to negative interest rates. So who's going to finance the commercial paper market? Who's going to finance a lot of overnight type money if you blow up the money market industry, which negative interest rates would do? So that's why I don't think it will happen here. And just to add on to one thing that David said when he mentioned that, and of course accurately, that each incremental easing cycle is higher in horsepower than the one prior. But at the same time, also, they're each of them are less effective because you become sort of desensitized to the changes in the cost of money when they are already low to begin with. So I agree that also with both that the Fed will fight this tooth and nail because that's just their MO. It's always the pressure to do something, and they still have in their models that lower rates are good, higher rates are not good. Lower rates are stimulative, higher rates are anti-growth, and it's very black and white. And they can rely on, you know, low inflation as giving them license, and they can give whatever reason they want for cutting. But that is always just their knee-jerk reaction and their sort of default setting. And we're going to see it again this time around. I think what separates the next downturn from others, and we're certainly seeing it in Japan and Europe, is we are not going to respond like we have in the past to that easing cycle. And that instead of seeing sort of a 12 to 18 month, you know, slowdown in growth or a couple of quarters and sort of this V bottom and economic activity and markets, this one is going to be more drawn out because we're not going to really respond to the easing. And then it's this, and I refer to it as this monetary quagmire, this Vietnam-type mentality that let's send in some troops. Okay, it's not working. It's not working because we don't have enough troops, and we need to send more troops in, and we have to send more troops in. We have to send more troops in, and we have to do more easing. We have to do more easing. We have to do more easing rather than any form of introspection to say, you know what, this is not working. Maybe we should try a different tact. So this economic downturn is going to be more drawn out, again, because we're not going to have that sort of monetary stimulus that we can react to. And certainly there's not going to be any fiscal stimulus because the U.S. government's already blown its load in terms of that, as they did last year. So this is going to be more of a bathroom type, or I should say a bathtub type recovery, that you're going to do a lot of bouncing along before you're going to see any strong growth, because we are a credit dependent economy and a credit cycle. And if the cost of money is permanently low, you don't get the impetus to act. I mean, that's the whole point of lowering rates on paper, is to make you buy that car today instead of tomorrow, make you buy that house today instead of tomorrow, make you invest in that plant today instead of tomorrow. Well, if rates are constantly low forever, well, there's no impetus in doing today what you can just wait till tomorrow to do. And I think that's the experience of what we've seen overseas, and we're certainly now seeing it here. And and I think that augurs for not a higher PE multiple just because rates are low. You look at the PE ratio in Japan for the past 30 years. It's been a steady decline downwards. So people can use their dividend discount models and their present value future cash flows and discount it at whatever they want. It hasn't worked in Japan. You've seen compressed valuations for 30 years. And I think that people are basically putting their chips on the stock market table here, assuming that multiples at worst will stay where they are and can possibly expand if the Fed starts cutting. Without really understanding or looking at why is the reason the Fed is cutting, and what is that going to do to future cash flows?
Ira, you wanted to comment?
Yeah, you know, I was just to throw this out there for a discussion, because the more I think about it, in the way that President Trump has used his tweeting account, I'm beginning to think that if he would stop tweeting and actually use back channels, that he could get what he wants out of the Fed. He desperately would like, I think, a 50 basis point cut. 25 won't do it because he wants, of course, the massive headline and it'll look like a victor. But he could, he actually controls this game, because if the Fed stays on hold and the president's response is, well, the hell is it? I'm not getting any support from the Fed. I may as well throw on some tariffs, and I'm going to scare everybody into doing the action that I want. Are we on that path to that collision? And is, would Jay Powell be smart enough to head that off? Because the president could certainly throw that out there, and he doesn't even have to enact the tariffs. But imagine if after the Fed meeting or after the testimony this week, you know, and it's a little bit more stay the course than the president would like to see, then does he come out and say, well, in 45 days or 30 days, well, certainly it'll take place after the next FOMC meeting, you know, I plan on going ahead with the increase on all on those $300 billion of Chinese products at 25% tariff. What do you think the impact of the markets are going to be? So, you know, if we begin to look at that through those types of glasses, is this another way to see it? That's what I'm asking. And I love, let me just paraphrase that. I love David's comment about the yield curve, what it's going to happen with all this debt, because I'm a believer in that too. For all the people who think that we're into a 210 inversion, I don't think we'll see it, because I think there's other issues at play here, even with the ECB doing what they're doing. And I would like to add, the bank that I talked about, which the Fed has actually gone to court to block, is called the Narrow Bank. And it was put together by a previous Fed official out of New York, Fed. And the Fed is trying to block it from happening, because they just want to collect deposits and put them on reserve at the Fed, because interest on excess reserves is so high that it's worth doing. So, but I await the other comments from Peter and David.
David, just first, your thoughts on Ira and Peter's commentary?
Well, I mean, just to further the conversation, I guess, on the Fed. Firstly, I think that the problem is that the president has boxed in the central bank, and so Donald Trump's not going to get what he wants by doing that. I know people like to talk about how previous presidents pressured Fed chairman. They did it privately, and people only found out about it years after the fact. So this is actually a sorry state of affairs. I actually think that the Fed over-tightened enough that they should take the funds rate down 50 basis points. They're not going to do it. I thought that for an instant at the press conference after the meeting, that Powell sounded so dovish that I thought, well, they are going to go 50. He walked that back. And of course, we already know that Jim Bullard, who was the only FOMC voter to have dissented, we find out ex post that he just wanted to cut 25 basis points. So they're going to cut 25 basis points. I mean, it's in the market, but I think that's what they're going to do. They're not going to cut 50. I think that this whole Fed bashing, and, you know, this is an institution that is run by human beings. And they make mistakes. And I already said that they had over-tightened. They'll have to walk that back. It's not the first time that we would have had the Fed over-tighten and then over-ease. That's what these cycles are all about. But I think that if Powell were to get, say, well, the newest word is demoted, I think that's going to have a deleterious impact. I don't think, you see, I don't think that Donald Trump fully understands the role and the benefit that the U.S. has globally by being the reserve currency. I think he has absolutely no appreciation of what that means. And actually, historically, the country with the reserve currency status tends to have trade deficits and tends to therefore have capital account surpluses. This whole economics team at the White House, I think, has to go back to school. I'm actually totally miffed at the level of economic thinking that goes on today at the White House. I hear Larry Kudlow today talking about how, well, Powell's job is safe for now. I've never seen a Fed chairman so harassed, but people have to understand it's not one man. He might be the chairman, but he has one vote, and it's a whole committee. So what happens if Trump fires him or demotes him, and everybody gets up and leaves? Because this is a team. It's not one person. And then it comes down to who is he going to, you know, put in charge of the Fed. I mean, he wanted to nominate Stephen Moore previously. I mean, can you imagine the trashing that the U.S. dollar will take in that sort of environment? And I know the president was criticizing Draghi, and here you have Europe much closer to recession than the U.S., and Draghi, of course, is then being accused of currency manipulation, which doesn't even make any sense in a world where you do have some semblance of floating exchange rates. We don't have fixed exchange rate regimes anymore, where you actually did outright devalue, but now apparently Europe is devaluing, which is just pure nonsense. But the risk here is that if there's a forced change at the Fed, I'll tell you this much, you do not want to be long the DXY the day before that happens. But you will want to be long gold, that much I can tell you too.
Here.
Final question for today is, what do you see as the biggest risks? So central bank risks, trade risks, market risks, credit risk, geopolitical risk to the economy and the financial markets for the rest of the year going into next year? And how do investors and traders protect themselves or look for opportunities in this environment? Maybe we'll begin with Peter.
Well, it's a confluence of risks that are all occurring at the same time. I mean, I think if the U.S. economy was strong, we'd be able to handle, you know, this trade spat. On the other hand, it is somewhat circular because it's the trade spat that has made the U.S. economy grow slower. And to David's point, I agree. You know, the Fed will always tighten too much and they'll always ease too much because they don't appreciate the different lags that are inherent in any policy, and that what you do today may not be felt for another 6 months from now. So, they were double tightening, shrinking their balance sheet and raising interest rates. They were double tightening. And because they had this delusional thought that shrinking the balance sheet wasn't a big deal and was watching paint dry, that had a cumulative impact on economic growth. And then I believe also a big risk is going to be this slowing and possibly declining earnings story, because it's going to feed into actual corporate behavior as companies try to protect profit margins, which are at record highs. So a major risk is that you get finally, for the first time in the cycle, mean reversion with respect to profit margins, which means slower hiring, which means slower spending, which means slower earnings growth, which potentially means lower stock prices, which then potentially means a problem with consumer spending. So they all sort of feed into each other, and it's now happening all together. And no amount of rate cuts are going to offset that. It's a cycle has begun, and it's going to play itself out, notwithstanding all the monetary firepower that will be thrown at it. But at least in the short term, I'd be very focused on earnings season and what companies have to say. Again, we're already seeing CFO and CEO confidence numbers that are getting impacted. And you just, you know, put yourself in their feet. If they're worried about the outlook, if they think there's going to be a recession, well, you can be sure that they're not going to be aggressively expanding their business. And I have to wonder, And a point that I've been agreeing with Dave for a while is that going into this year, companies were going to start focusing on their balance sheet because it got overlevered, and they were going to start making that a priority. And we've seen a slowdown in corporate buybacks in the first quarter. And I believe that, the fourth quarter of 2018 was the peak in stock buybacks, again, as a way for companies to try to improve their balance sheet, sort of hoard cash this time around, protect their profit margins, and deal with what is at least an earnings recession that is potentially going to be an economic recession, which will then enhance the downside of the earnings recession.
And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, Peter covered most of what needs to be said, because all those events that you talk about, you know, I put it in Maoist terms. These are all prairie fires, and it only takes a single, you know, potential prairie fires. They're dry tinder, geopolitical, certainly the economic, and that combines thereof. You've got instability throughout the Mideast, and you have a lot of actors out there who would like to light that spark, because that spark, because of what Peter, David, and I think fear most, I'm not trying to put words in their mouth, but I think they would say it from what they've said today, is the huge amount of debt buildup that makes this such the system, the global financial system, so vulnerable to this. And then the bottom line is this: the positions that exist out there in the financial community, and I'll tell you this, short volatility plays, which have been the backbone of many hedge fund and private equity groups' profitability, because they, as long as they believe the Fed has their back, they just sell vol. And I'm not talking about just selling vol in the equity markets. I'm not talking about just selling vol in debt markets. They're short gold vol. They're short currency vol. Short across the board, because the Fed has set this up. And I believe that it's one of the things that unnerved Powell back in late December, because he had gotten wind of, you know, the phenomenal moves we saw in December, partly because of the change in the U.S. Regs under what type of liquidity you needed on your balance sheet for year end, coupled with these enormous amounts of short vol positioning. Really, that's the greatest pile of dry tinder in the global financial system. And I'll tell you this, there's on the CME floor with these huge option, euro dollar option groups, there's been a lot of pain for the last 2 weeks. And they say, you know, this is hearsay, about it, three of the big five trading groups have blown out, that they've gotten crushed because volatility exploded since the Powell's press conference in June 19th. So they really got fractured by that. And I think there's mega amounts of this that exists around the world. But I want to add one more thing, because I'm not letting David off the hook. Bank of Canada meets tomorrow. I want to know what his view, especially as the Canadian dollar is strengthened here enough. Is there a chance, you know, that'll be the end, but to speak to what the Bank of Canada may do tomorrow.
David?
Well, I think the Bank of Canada does nothing tomorrow, and I think it'll be just a steady as she goes press statement, because they're locked in this tug of war between some of the recent positive economic data flow in Canada, which suggests that second quarter GDP growth could be 2.5 to 3%. Of course, that comes after 6 months of almost no growth at all, and of course we're caught between that and the deterioration we're seeing in the global economic outlook. So I think there'll be some tip of the hat to the improvement in domestic demand. A lot of that is oil and gas related from the trough. But of course, acknowledging that these global economic and political risks haven't gone away. In terms of you know, some of the things I think that we have to be really concerned about, you know, I say this because you know, actually, Powell's monetary policy report, the Fed's monetary policy report, you know, not the speech that we're going to get tomorrow or the testimony, but the report came out over the weekend, and the word risk showed up 34 times, and none of them are upside risks. And the word uncertainty showed up 34 times too. So that's 68 references to either uncertainty or risks in a 46-page document. And so I think that, you know, for me, you know, the retreat that we're seeing in global trade volumes is a big concern. We have a very fragile trade truce right now between the U.S. and China. But right now, Japan and South Korea are locked into a trade war, which has acted as a big impediment to the Asian technology space over the past few weeks. I think that the situation in Iran, I mean, to me, this is really big. What Iran is doing in pushing the envelope on its enrichment caps, to me, is a huge source of potential instability. I'm concerned about debt globally, but primarily I am concerned about the extreme fragility in China's financial system. I would add to all this something we didn't mention, but will certainly be making the headlines through the fall, which is Boris Johnson and his bravado about his willingness to push his own envelope on a no-deal Brexit coming into the October 31st deadline. I think, once again, Brexit's going to make the front pages of the paper. That'll be, alongside these trade issues in Iran, just ongoing sources of instability that leave me with this portfolio recommendation of having the bond bullion barbell in a ongoing search for refuge in troubled times. I think that another risk is the Fed dragging its heels. And actually, my heart goes out to Jay Powell, because what do you do? You certainly cannot be seen to be kowtowing to the president. And I think he should go 50. I think that the risk for me, and this is a risk for the markets, is that if the Fed actually tells the markets on July 31st that this cut is only an insurance cut, if they can't see the decay in the leading indicators, then I think they're going to fall further behind the growth curve and will make it that much tougher to get out of the recession that I actually think is inevitable. It's just a matter of which quarter it's going to land in. And then I think that, you know, once we get through all this, and it was interesting that Peter had mentioned, you know, the NFIB Small Business Sentiment Index today, because there's a component that measures uncertainty. It's called the Uncertainty Index. And boy, did that thing shoot up in the month of June. Interesting enough, the same month that the stock market takes off, the uncertainty index took off as well. And you have to start to wonder if businesses are starting to pay attention to the 2020 election. And if you're looking at Donald Trump's approval ratings at 40%, and you're looking at this lineup of Democratic candidates, you don't know post-2020 what your tax rate's going to look like anymore. And that alone is going to cause businesses at the margin to put money aside for a rainy day. And that just adds more credence to the CapEx-led recession thematic that I've been talking about this year.
You know, those are really great points. And I'm going to throw in one more element that we haven't discussed. But there's a guy who's sitting in Moscow, who understands the vulnerability of the global system. I think you see it regularly. And he wants those sanctions lifted. So if you want to see somebody who potentially could light that spark, Vladimir Putin is no fool. And he sees the vulnerabilities at hand. So I would think you're going to see a more aggressive Russia, just in an effort to get some of those. He wants those sanctions removed in the worst way. And actually, Russian assets have been holding up very nicely here. But I think that's one more major element in the global instability that exists, and it's not even far below the surface. It's at the surface.
Wow, great insight, gentlemen. How can our listeners learn more about your work, Peter?
They're interested in asset management or wealth management type advice, bleakley.com. And you can read my daily notes at bookreport.com.
And Ira?
still, well, I've been a little quiet for a while, but Notes from Underground, which is my blog, but and you can sign up for it at iraharris.com, and you get an overview of my thinking on potential global macro-based trades. It's all discretionary. There's no touting of trades. There's just the concepts, and you have to go do your own risk analysis and do your own work to see if they fit for you.
And David.
Okay, well, for anybody that is interested in looking at my research, feel free to call me, 416-681-8919, or 647-802-4146. Feel free to email me. The email is drosenberg@glutzenschef.com. And you can actually also follow me on Twitter, David Rosenberg at Econ Guy Rosie. A lot of people think it's more like Wise Guy Rosie, but you can follow me on on Econ Guy Rosie and see my daily snippets on there too.
Great. Thank you very much, gentlemen. And we'll end it there.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.